Welcome to the audio podcast of The Table at Central United Methodist Church. The podcast currently features the messages of Matt Smith and Linda Du Hirsu.
With a musical introduction by Brendan Lowe, our director of music. Thanks for listening.
Gospel reading is from the Gospel of Luke, chapter 9, verses 51 through 62. So when the days drew near for him to be taken up, he set his face to go to Jerusalem, and he sent messengers ahead of him. On their way, they entered a village of the Samaritans to make ready for him, but they did not receive him because his face was set to Jerusalem. Now when his disciples James and John saw it, they said, "Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and to consume them?" But he turned and he rebuked them. Then they went on to another village. As they were going along the road, someone said to him, "I will follow you wherever you go." And Jesus said to him, "Foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head." Now to another he said, "Follow me." But that one said, "Lord, first let me go and bury my father." But Jesus said to him, "Let the dead bury their own dead, but as for you, go and proclaim the kingdom of God." Another said, "I will follow you, Lord, but let me first say farewell to those at my home." Jesus said to him, "No one who puts a hand to the plow and looks back is fit for the kingdom of God."
You know the situation can't be right, and all you ever do is fight. But there's a reason that the road is long. It takes some time to make your courage strong. Hold on tight a little longer. What don't kill you makes you stronger. Get back up, cause it's a hard love.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Amari and Casey and fellow musicians. That was beautiful and fits perfectly with what we're going to be talking about today. That song is in the film The Last Black Man in San Francisco, and I could see some folks singing along because the song's been around a long time and has created lots of good memories. I'm honored to be with you today. I'm going to focus on community and conflict, and I'm going to pose a question to you. Can tension create stronger communities? Can tension create stronger communities, better people? I have a confession to make. I don't believe in balance. It's a lie. I have never felt balanced in my life. I careen into self-care. I try to eat a balanced diet, and then at the grocery store, I buy a bag of Cheetos, put it in my cart, and on the way home, I move that bag into the front seat and open the Cheetos bag and take a few. And by the time I get home, it's only a few blocks away, but somehow my hand is coated in my sin. And I'm so disgusted that I throw the last few Cheetos in the bag into the trash. I clearly live in tension with Cheetos. I sit down to do some writing and put on the news, and suddenly I'm so enraged. I'm out of balance, and I've lost my inspiration. And I have never not had a tension-filled experience trying to park at the Trader Joe's parking lot on Folsom. Are those low prices worth the tension, the conflict that I feel as I try to make that turn in or risk getting my car towed by secretly parking at the parking lots around? I have not solved the problem except biking there. Being balanced is like a too perfect picture of someone's hashtag blessed life on Instagram or Facebook. It's an image, but is it real? I certainly can't find balance in my life, and I don't think communities work when they pursue balance because it's an illusion. I confess, I believe in tension. And I'm going to show you an artist that kind of illustrates that point by creating tensions in her work. Her name is Janine Antony. And in this first image, she's done a kind of classical style artwork, a bust of herself, a self-portrait, but it's made out of interesting material. On our left, that's chocolate. And on the right, that's soap. She did 14 of these, and the title is Lick and Lather. So what do you think she did with the chocolate? Yeah, she licked it, which creates a sort of interesting thing because it's a self-portrait, so that she's in dialogue with her image, with her body, with herself, pleasure. And the other one is made out of soap, and of course, you guessed it, she bathed with those self-portraits, washing herself with herself in a way. So theological in a way, we're often talking about self in Christian theology. She says, I'm very interested in the fact that both acts are very loving, that licking myself and, you know, washing myself, this bust was like being in the tub washing your baby or something. It's a very loving act, but at the same time, I'm sort of erasing myself. So there's this strange tension going on, which I think is an interesting relationship with how we feel about who we are. Tension between, am I more than my physical appearance? How am I connected to others? I'm going to show you another work by her. It's a short video of a performance art piece slash video art that was on the PBS show Art 21 a few years ago. Yeah, here it is. And listen carefully. She says a lot of really profound things.
Practice tightroping for about an hour a day, and after about a week I started to feel like I'm now getting my balance. I started to notice that it wasn't that I was getting more balanced, but that I was getting more comfortable with being out of balance. Rather than getting nervous and overcompensating, I could just compensate enough, and I thought, I wish I could do that in my life. After going down many different avenues, I decided to make this work touch. And what I did is I went home to the Bahamas, to the beach that was directly in front of the house that I grew up in. It made sense for me to go back to this horizon I had looked at my whole life. thought it would have much more tension if I could walk along the rope and as it dipped, that just for a moment I would touch the horizon.
I love that. Just for a moment, touch the horizon. So profound. And I like what she says about balance. She says, I'm balanced. Well, actually, I'm more comfortable, what?
Being out of
balance. Exactly. And she uses that word tension in there, which is sort of my word for the day. This idea of this tension, this tightrope that is along the horizon. And I love horizons in art because they remind us, they kind of draw our attention to this thing that we use to orient ourselves, that it's around us as we're spinning in space on this globe we call Earth. It orients us to this position that we have, and yet it's an illusion, right? That line that you see at the beach or the mountain, or out across the city, the fields. It's an illusion. It just is this borderless border that's between us and infinite space. With that idea of the infinite, let's look back at the gospel reading. Because there's some tensions there. And I'm going to read it in the Message version, which is a kind of more contemporary version. When it came time for his ascension, talking about Jesus, he gathered up his courage and steeled himself for the journey to Jerusalem. He sent messengers ahead. They came to a Samaritan village to make arrangements for his hospitality. But when the Samaritans learned that his destination was Jerusalem, they refused. When the disciples, James and John, heard of it, they said, Master, do you want us to call a bolt of lightning down from the sky and incinerate them? And Jesus turned to them, and in the Message, they really make this clear. Jesus turned to them and said, of course not. And then they traveled on to another village. A lot of biblical commentaries explain this by calling it the beginning of Jesus' journey to Jerusalem. It's really the beginning of the end. And it's a change in the relationship of that community. There's tensions that exist as they're wrestling with this really profound encounter that they've had with this person, this being that's challenging their kind of spiritual, but also with the Samaritans' racial understandings of who they are. Their refusal is frankly not surprising because the Jews and Samaritans have really been in conflict for quite a while, denying hospitality to each other and even personhood, border crossings for a long time. We shouldn't be surprised, and I don't think Jesus was surprised that the Samaritans would fail to welcome the pilgrims. In fact, one could argue that Jesus knew this history and probably knew how the Samaritans would react. He wasn't afraid of that tension. It was a teaching moment. It would cause tension, but it was a time for his community to show something that's bigger. Tensions are a part of life, but when conflict escalates to violence, which is where it went there, in at least James and John's mind, things have gone too far. Clearly, followers of Christ are supposed to reject violent revenge. In an age of possible U.S. missiles in the sky, raining down in random revenge over manufactured conflicts. This reminds us that true followers of Christ say, of course not. Duh. The story continues with Jesus heading toward Jerusalem, his end. On the road, someone asked if he could go along. I'll go with you whenever, he said. And the Message again gets a little real. It says, Jesus was curt. I usually don't think of Jesus like that. He's just gentle Jesus, meek and mild. But here, Jesus was curt. Are you ready to rough it? We're not staying in the best inns, you know. Jesus said to another, follow me. He said, "Certainly, but first excuse me for a couple of days, please. I have to make arrangements for my father's funeral." Jesus refused. "First things first, your business is life, not death, and life is urgent. Announce God's kingdom." And then another said, "I'm ready to follow you, Master, but first excuse me while I get things straightened out at home." Jesus said, "No procrastination," which when I read that, I realized I needed to stop watching so much U.S. soccer this week and focus on this sermon, even though those games were amazing. "No backward looks. You can't put God's kingdom off till tomorrow. Seize the day." And that idea, seize the day, is going to come back. So these are kind of tension-filled texts. It's not the sort of Jesus that we think about in the Sermon of the Mount, "Blessed are the meek, they'll inherit the kingdom of God." Here you have a Jesus who's really forcing people to make decisions about how they connect to communities. Jesus seems harsh in this text, but I follow it calling me to a reflection on the tension in the relationship circles that I'm a part of, large and small. Let the natural parts of life go for a moment. There's something supernatural here. You can't always balance your commitments. We live in tension with them. There's something supernatural here when we do that, where two or three are gathered. That's part of the tension in this story, which mirrors our reality now. Of course, family and funerals matter. So does shopping at Trader Joe's and catching a film. But by definition, together is how community happens. It's pretty hard to connect to others alone. Together, we announce God's kingdom. Or as I learned from a friend years ago, by removing the G, because we don't really believe in kings, at least in America, we have a kingdom, a spiritually connected family, a kinship, a community for good. Seize the day, seize the moment, not here together just as individuals trying to do good, but as a group, kin at the table in Northern California, working in community to refresh and realize their ideals. It reminds me that a lot of church-related following of Christ means volunteering. Volunteering to make food, help refugees, clean out junk, drive someone somewhere, volunteer to donate. Time and money are the real sacrifices that we make these days. And the fact that this community has recently stepped out and achieved some major financial goals and continues to staff a series of charitable efforts shows that making sacrifices for a community based on shared profound ideals works. How? By taking the long view. So I'm going to show you the trailer for the film The Last Black Man in San Francisco, but I'm not going to really dig into the plot. The plot is, it's really a mood. It's poetry, visual poetry. Of course, it takes on major issues, race, friendship, gentrification, housing, but it does it in a way that kind of, well, it gets to, I've seen it twice and it gets to my heart. It challenges my assumptions of what all of those things mean. The story centers on two friends who love a Victorian house, you could say. It's also about how we create stories. Black identity, family, art, and how we go through and think about the tension-filled pain of change in a community. The other thing I'll tell you is that the filmmakers grew up together in San Francisco, and it really became a community project. The director didn't go to film school, didn't go to college, and in fact dropped out of high school. And this year, won the Best Director Award at the Sundance Film Festival, which is incredible. That's a pretentious place. There's a line in the film that lingers for me. People aren't one thing. people aren't one thing. And as you watch this, feel that mood. Of course, it's a trailer, so it's also about selling the movie to you. It's at the Tower Theater this week. And if you watch it, I'd love to hear what you think about it. But while you're watching this, pay attention to how it's shot, because I can't show you clips from it that's still in the theater. I could only show you the trailer, but the trailer gives you a feel for the visuals of the film. And I'm actually going to talk about the visuals, because I think the visuals connect us, are as important as the story in giving us a portrait of people living in tension, trying to understand who they are. So if we'll play that.
We built these ships, dredged these canals in the San Francisco they never knew existed. This is our home. You two stick together.
I always come back to the old house. What if it's empty? What if we just peeked inside?
We could throw parties. You could put on one of your plays. We could yell.
It is this house.
Our old house.
That's not your old house, and that's not your neighborhood.
Hey, if you're going to San Francisco, be sure to wear flowers in your hair.
Maybe he's right. What if we shouldn't be here? Well, we should be here more.
Some millionaire.
We can keep doing this.
But I'm not leaving. I'm the last one left.
I'm with you, bro. Yep.
I'll draw your attention to the table up here, which is amazing because it connects with the film. So thanks for making it. The flowers you may have seen in there, the skateboard, and I'll give one part away. The skateboard gets broken in the film, and it's broken on the table here. So incredible. That's the only thing I'll give away. Don't worry. It's not a major plot point. But I love the feel of this film because it challenges my identity, and it helps me to see through another person's eyes. Jimmy Fails, the main character, there holding the skateboard, is wrestling with his community as it's changing. And if you don't mind, I'm going to share a little bit of film theory with you that will, I think, help us see what's going on in a film like this, but also see our communities and our world in different ways. Did you know that one of the first serious thinkers about movies was a Frenchman named André Bazin, who thought that the best films connect us to the divine? Back in the 1940s and 50s, he really hated quick cuts in film. Think of montage sequences. I can only imagine how much he'd look in horror at a great blockbuster action film with all those digitized characters and those quick cuts. What he really liked was the long take with a wide open frame where our eyes can move around inside the scene. At the heart of Bazin's strictures on cinematic realism lies the conviction that the movie camera, by the simplest act of photographing the world, testifies to the miracle of God's creation. For Bazan, this moral duty is ultimately a sacred one. The photographic media are, in effect, preordained to bear endless witness to the beauty of the cosmos. That's why I like art. Throughout the ages, Andre argues, mankind has dreamed of being able to see the surface of the world faithfully copied into art. Think about the history of art and that tension between abstraction and representation. Bazan describes this wish in what he calls the mummy complex, an innate human need to halt the ceaseless flow of time by embalming it into an image. We want to freeze a moment, capture a moment. Did you find that sometimes when you're having so much fun, maybe you're at a concert or with friends and family, there's that moment of, I want to sit back and enjoy this for a second. I want to be involved in it. Do we stop the family reunion and take a photo, or do we let the laughs keep going? Do I hold up my camera and take a picture of the musician, or should I just sit there and enjoy the music? In the name of higher realism, Bazan celebrated the long interrupted take, which you see over and over again in this film, for its capacity to simulate the most elemental aspect of nature, its continuousness. And I love in a film that's about change, community change, the tension of housing and gentrification and race and money and power, that you have these long takes where the eye is not controlled as much, but is allowed to look around and enjoy little details, just like the characters enjoy the little details of this house, their home. Since everything in the film frame can be seen with equal clarity, the audience has to decide for itself what is meaningful and interesting. Bazan argues that it gives an audience more freedom. Sometimes I feel controlled in some contemporary films because the cuts are so intense. When I watch music videos, I feel that way as well. You have an incredible dance performance, and suddenly you just get like a moment of 20 people doing some incredible motion. Why not just leave the camera going? But that's just me. In short, deep focus cinematography, it invites us to an awareness of the tension between our personal freedom, I want to look around, and ethical responsibility. What do I do with what I see? In cinema, as in life, we must be free to find comfort in this imbalance. In The Last Black Man in San Francisco, we need the long view. It tells us, it teaches me to slow down and to appreciate a community that pushes us beyond our horizons. Henry David Thoreau writes, "Could a greater miracle occur than for us to look through each other's eyes for an instant?" I love that when people want to talk about miracles. To me, that's the most profound miracle. This week, as I worked through these ideas, I sat down with Greg Eddy, a member of the table here. I got to know him working on some refugee resettlement projects. And I wanted to get his thoughts on tension from his work as a labor leader. He told me some great stories of how bringing tension to the surface actually created progress. And then he stated this point: the one thing that always happens through embracing tension, through conflict, is this: you get movement. You get movement. The Stonewall fighters, athletes who take a knee, Tara O'Sullivan bravely entering the darkness where a domestic abuser was hiding with assault weapons. I have no words for these heroes. But Greg also shared a poem with me, and I'm going to read you part of it. It's called "The Low Road," from "The Moon Is Always Female" by Marge Piercy. Two people can keep each other sane, can give comfort, conviction, love, a massage, hope, sex. Three people are a delegation, a committee, a wedge. With four, you can play bridge, start an organization. With six, you can rent a whole house, eat pie for dinner with no seconds, and hold a fundraising party. A dozen, make a demonstration. 100, fill a hall. 1,000, have solidarity and your own newsletter. 10,000, power and your own paper. 100,000, your own media. 10 million, your own country. It goes on one at a time. It starts when you care to act. It starts when you do it again after they said no. It starts when you say we and know who you mean. And each day you mean one more. Maybe there's hope in communities that embrace tension, making choices. Maybe they are the only way we seize the day. I'm going to end with a story. A few years ago, here in Northern California, a little girl idolized her 10-year-old brother so much that she'd follow him around and copy everything that he did. He started playing soccer and she begged to play with him, so he taught her how to dribble the ball and pass with the inside of her foot. He moved on to other things, but she kept playing soccer. When he was 15, he got caught bringing meth to school and went to prison. She kept playing soccer, driving hours to find the best coaching, including playing for a team in Elk Grove. Her brother continued to go in and out of jail, driven by his heroin addiction, while she went to college on a scholarship. While in prison, he joined a white supremacist gang and got Nazi tattoos, shocking his entire family, especially his sister, who still loved him. He loved her, in fact, a lot. He was known in prison, including times at Pelican Bay, for always talking about her incredible skills. Once he built a tower out of 60 books from the prison library, tied them together, climbed on top so he could look down a hall out of his prison cell to see a 15-inch television where his sister was playing one of her major international matches. Her sister was becoming a star and was also increasingly vocal about social injustice. Do you know who I'm talking about? Some of you might. When she made a huge goal, she grabbed a microphone and sang the first bars of Born in the USA back in 2011 when the U.S. beat Colombia. He began to not just climb up books, but to read them. When he was in solitary confinement, he had a guy next door, and they would write long letters to each other and pass them to each other with thread. His name was Monster, an African-American man who taught him what it was like growing up in South Central L.A. He changed his views in prison, got his Nazi tattoos lasered off. And when Colin Kaepernick took a knee, she, Megan Rapinoe, a lesbian from Redding, California, was the first white professional athlete to join him. The team that she used to play for near here was at that time called the Elk Grove Pride. Speaking of our local community, I think this Sacramento-made work of art done by two graduates of Sac State, Sean Berner and Francesca Gomez, illustrates this. It appeared at the Art Street show in 2017 off of Broadway. Maybe some of you went to that show. I see some heads nodding. I love this. The colors, the rest of the world gray. Everything in that room was gray. The mayor took a picture with this work of art you can see online. I love this individual who, in the middle of that kind of gray world, is casting a vision. And it's a work that you can kind of walk into and be a part of, and so I think it does invite a community-type participation. And of course, in the middle of this vision, I like how that person is being blown backward. There's tension in that vision. That whole space is being used. It's explosive. It's so powerful. From an interview with the creators in Juxtapose magazine, they respond to this question: what would you tell someone who wants to try and do something like this for their community? And the artists, Sacramento artists, say, dream it up and do everything you can to make it happen. Fail multiple times. Then don't repeat mistakes. Find a strong team that believes in the vision and is ready to execute. I'll end with these lines from Megan Rapinoe that I think echo a little bit of what we heard from Jesus. Me too, Black Lives Matter, and LGBTQ advocacy. To me, it's literally all the same, she says, insofar as I want people to respect who I am, what I am, being gay, being a woman, being a professional athlete, whatever. She adds, what kind of person do you want to be for yourself, but also in the larger context of the country and in the world? Megan says, you have to seize the moment. Jesus says, you have to seize the day. Take the long view. Together, in tension, it's the only way we create hope for our communities. Thank you.
If you're going to San Francisco, be sure to wear some flowers in your hair. If you're going to San Francisco, you're gonna meet some jazz.